Welcome back to Cresta in the Afternoon. This is Peter Herbeck, your host, sitting in for Al Cresta. And it's my joy to be able to welcome Roy Shulman. Roy is a Jewish man who grew up in New York City, a conservative Jewish parents and family. His parents were fled the Nazi Holocaust in Germany. And over time, in the interesting journey and inspiring journey of Roy's life, he came to know Jesus as Messiah. And the Lord led him into the Catholic Church. And Roy shares his story in a wonderful book, an inspiring book, and encourage anybody to read, called Salvation is from the Jews. I want to ask Roy to be with us today to talk about Paul's perspective on the conversion of the Jews. Welcome, Roy.
Hi, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Yes, thank you so much. I wonder if, for just a few minutes, you might give us a little thumbnail of your own story.
Sure, I'd love to. As you mentioned a moment ago, my parents were German Jewish Holocaust refugees. I grew up in a suburb of New York City, very Jewish, went to Jewish religious education all the way from the beginning of school until university. Was quite devout growing up. Went to MIT undergraduate and pretty much lost my faith there in the, kind of scientific, science knows better than to believe in religion kind of attitude that was prevalent at the time. Then I went on to Harvard Business School, did well enough there to be invited back to join the faculty, found myself as a new professor of marketing at Harvard Business School at the ripe old age of 29, a kind of insufferable yuppie, very full of myself. And that's really when the bottom fell out of my world, because I had always felt growing up that there has to be a real meaning and purpose to life, and when I'm older, I'll come to know it. I, as a child, thought that would come from knowing God, and later, as I grew up, thought it would come from my career. But here, I was more successful than I ever hoped to be in my career, and there was still no meaning to life, so I fell into a kind of existential despair. And it was in that state, I was walking in nature early one morning, and I received the spectacular grace of, from one moment to the next, the veil between earth and heaven dropped. I found myself in the presence of God, very knowingly in the presence of God, seeing my life as though I had died, and was looking back over my life in the presence of God. And I saw instantaneously how I would feel about everything after I died, and what would be important, and what wouldn't be important, and what I would be kicking myself about, and so forth. I saw a whole range of theological truths. I saw I saw about divine providence. I saw about that every action has a moral content that's actually observed and weighed in the balance and recorded for all eternity. I saw that everything that had ever happened to me had been the most perfect thing that could have been arranged, coming from an all-knowing, all-loving God. I saw that this God not only knew me by name and watched over me every moment of my existence and controlled everything that happened to me, but he actually felt everything that I felt at every moment, and in some sense was happy when I was happy and was sad when I was sad. So I saw all of this pretty much instantaneously, and I knew that the meaning and purpose of my life was to worship and serve my Lord and God and Master, who was revealing himself to me. But what I didn't know was what his name was and what religion to follow. And I prayed on the spot, let me know your name so I know what religion to worship and serve you properly. I don't mind if you're Buddha and I have to become Buddhist. I don't mind if you're Apollo and I have to become a Roman pagan. I don't mind if you're Krishna and I have to become Hindu, as long as you're not Christ and I have to become Christian.
Yeah.
So he didn't reveal his name to me. But a year later, after that experience, I prayed every night before going to sleep to know the name of my Lord and Master and God who had revealed himself to me. And a year later, actually to the day, I went to sleep and I had a very vivid sleeping experience of the Blessed Virgin Mary. I thought I was awake at the time, but I know that physically I was asleep. But I had what seemed to me to be an audience with the Blessed Virgin Mary, in which she offered to answer any questions I had for her, and I asked her some questions and so forth. And the next morning when I woke up, I realized, of course, that it had been Christ in the initial experience, and I knew who the Blessed Virgin Mary was. And that pretty much led me fairly directly to the Catholic Church.
That's a long way from MIT.
It's a long way from MIT, but it's a whole lot better.
Yeah, isn't that wonderful? I know the Paul talks about, in Romans chapter 11, the God's plan for the Jewish people. I think many Catholics, many Christians wonder if Jesus is the Jewish Messiah, why are there so few Jews who accept Jesus as the Messiah? And part of that answer I know is in God's plan. We just want to just raise this question. We're going to a break here. Ron, I wonder as we come back if you can help open up for us Paul's perspective on Romans chapter 11.
Sure, love to.
Thank you. Welcome back to Cresta in the Afternoon. This is Peter Herbeck sitting in for Al Cresta. And we've been talking to Roy Shulman. Roy just shared with us his very moving, very inspiring story. In just 4 minutes' time, too, almost the whole story, in some ways, a wonderful summary of how the Lord opened his heart to come to understand that Jesus is indeed the Jewish Messiah. And Roy's story is in his book, Salvation is from the Jews. I'd highly recommend it. It's really a wonderful read, a very inspiring read. And in that book, Roy speaks about Paul's teaching in Romans chapter 11 about the destiny and God's plan for the Jewish people. And in part, that answers the question of why more Jews today don't receive Jesus as Messiah. Roy, what does Paul have to say to us about it?
Let me lay a little groundwork, which is, you know, basically there's a middle path you have to follow in understanding the mystery of the role of Jews and Judaism in between the first and second coming of Christ.
Okay.
You can fall into error to the left or to the right, so to speak. You can fall into the error of what can be called extreme supersessionism, that with the coming of Christ, all of the promises, all of the election, everything special about the Jews has been transferred to the church, and there is no continuing relevance whatsoever to Jewish identity or Judaism. And that's one error. Another error is you can fall into the error that since the Jews were given this very special salvific set of promises from God 4,000 years ago, they still have them, so they don't need Christ and they don't need Christianity. And there's no reason to evangelize the Jews because they're already saved through Judaism. And those are both, from the perspective of Catholic doctrine, serious errors. But one has to be aware of those two errors because you have to see how carefully Paul walks a kind of a middle line, illuminating the truth which falls in between those two. And the place where he does this more than any place else is Romans chapter 11. He starts out he starts out saying at the beginning of the chapter, I ask then, has God rejected his people? By no means. God has not rejected his people whom he foreknew. So he's kind of rejecting that extreme supersessionism. But then he goes on to say something very interesting. He says, what then? Israel failed to obtain what it sought. The elect obtained it, but the rest were hardened. As it is written, God gave them a spirit of stupor, eyes that should not see and ears that should not hear, down to this very day. Let their eyes be darkened so that they cannot see. So there's this tremendous mystery he's opening up here, that the failure of the Jews in Jesus' day, and by implication for the subsequent 2,000 years, the failure of the Jews to recognize Jesus wasn't only due to their hard-heartedness or their unwillingness to see, but it was part in itself of divine providence that God gave them a spirit of stupor, eyes that should not see and ears that should not hear, down to this very day. And then he goes at the end of the chapter, he says, lest you be wise in your own conceits, I want you to understand this mystery, brethren. A hardening has come upon part of Israel until the full number of the Gentiles come in, and so all Israel will be saved. So he's painting this picture that there's this intermediate period in between Christ and after the full number of the Gentiles come in between the first coming of Christ and essentially when the full number of the Gentiles come in the second coming of Christ, when the eyes of the Jews will be darkened so that a large number of them won't recognize Christ. But then once the full number of the Gentiles has come in, before the second coming, the veil will be lifted and the Jews too, as he says, all Israel will be saved. And as Catholics, we know this also from the Catechism, paragraph 674 of the New Catechism says, quote, the glorious Messiah's coming is suspended at every moment of history until his recognition by all Israel. In other words, the second coming has to wait until the conversion of the Jews.
Yes, in our own time, we do see, though, Roy, there seems to be a trickle. I mean, you're an example. My wife actually is an example. Was in Israel this past year, and there are these messianic synagogues of Jews who have come to receive Jesus as Messiah. They seem to be growing. I was in Eastern Europe, in Ukraine, near the Crimea, and met a whole group, hundreds of Jewish people who came to receive Jesus as Messiah. So there seems to be, is it just my perception, or is there something percolating that's out of the ordinary, maybe, in terms of the number of Jews who might be responding to who Jesus is?
I mean, I think it's a trickle, like once a dam breaks, you know, there's a stream that comes through and it, you know, it accelerates and gets greater and greater. I think the Jewish conversion to Christ now is the greatest since apostolic times. And there are statistics to back that up. One evidence of that is the Messianic Jewish movement itself. Mm-hmm. It didn't exist before 1967. There was nothing called Messianic Judaism. Mm-hmm. And now there are 250, 300 Messianic Jewish congregations in the United States, essentially congregations of Jews who understand that Jesus was the Jewish Messiah and who want to worship Jesus as the Messiah within a Jewish context. Mm-hmm. There are probably 200, 250,000 Messianic Jews in the United States, when in 1967 there were maybe 1,000, and there were maybe, you know, two communities of them. And in Israel, too, in Israel, I spoke to a Messianic Jewish woman who lives in Israel who told me there isn't a city or town in Israel without one of those Messianic Jewish congregations, as you mentioned. So, and you mentioned Eastern Europe. There's been tremendous Jewish coming to Christianity in the former Soviet Union and in Eastern Europe.
Mm-hmm. Now, of those Messianic Jews who I've met kind of along the way, the majority of them have all been influenced by evangelical Christianity, evangelical Protestantism. And I mean, I do know, we do know various Catholics, Jewish Catholics. But why is it that it seems like most of those Messianic Jews have been connected with either Pentecostalism or evangelical Christianity?
Well, I think it's because the missionary outreach or the evangelical outreach or the sharing the gospel with the Jewish community isn't coming from Catholics and the Catholic Church. It's coming from other Messianic Jews and from, you know, Protestants. And, I mean, I think that's, but frankly, it's a tragedy for the Jews who get alienated from their families, become the enemy because they, you know, believe in Jesus, and then they don't get the sacraments, and they don't get the fullness of what Jesus came to bring the world.
Yeah.
You know, they got kind of stuck two-thirds of the way down the road. It's not a matter of blame, but I think part of that responsibility is at the feet of the Catholic Church and or of Catholics who have backed off mm-hmm. from any sense of evangelizing the Jews. And I obviously want to encourage them, you know, to kind of reverse
sure.
that.
Sure. And well, I think there's been a mixed message even from, you know, levels of leadership in parts of the church where some who are responsible for the dialogue with the Jews, or at least at some level have some involvement with that, have sent, you know, sent the message out that basically, as you were saying earlier, look, the Jewish people have their own covenant. That covenant is salvific for them, and it's a kind of form of anti-Semitism, maybe, to be, quote-unquote, proselytizing them. And how do you respond to that?
Exactly. That's why I brought it up as yeah. one of the two errors that people can fall into. It's known as the dual covenant theology or dual covenant theory, and it's frankly it's nonsense, and it contradicts Catholic doctrine and dogma. It contradicts everything Jesus said. I mean, it was to a Jew that Jesus said, unless you're born again, you know, of water and the Spirit, you have no life within you. And it was to Jews he said, you know, unless you eat my body and drink my blood, you know, you have no eternal life. So obviously Jesus didn't believe in the dual covenant theory, but I think what's happened is, because of the error of supersessionism, you know, there's this tendency towards a pendulum swing or bending over
yes.
backwards.
Yeah.
It's always harder to find the middle ground than to go from one extreme to the opposite extreme.
Yeah, yeah. For Catholics who are listening, would say, you know, I have a number of Jewish friends, but I've never spoken to them about my faith. I always felt like that was maybe out of bounds. Plus, I wouldn't know how. I wouldn't even know how to begin a conversation. I don't want to offend anybody. What do I do? What kind of advice would you give them?
Well, first I'd say shame on you. But anyway, I think that to me the answer is very easy, which is, you know, you don't have to talk to them about, you know, don't you know that you have to accept Jesus to be saved, or to, you don't have to talk to them as though you're telling them what they have to do. But what you should do is let them know what you have, because mm-hmm. what a Catholic has in a state of grace is what everyone in the world wants, especially the Jews. Because, I mean, what were the Jews? They were the people chosen at random from all the people on the earth to yearn for the coming of the Messiah, to pray for the coming of the Messiah, to have a very particular hunger and thirst for the Messiah for 2,000 years until they brought about the Incarnation. Of course, they still have that hunger and thirst, and the only place where it can be satisfied is what is where you, as a Catholic, are able to satisfy it in the sacraments of the Catholic Church. So just let them know what it means to you to receive communion. Let them know what communion is, that you believe it's the body, blood, soul, and divinity of God made man. Let them know what your relationship with the Blessed Virgin Mary means. Let them know, like, Catholics respond to events in life differently. If there's a tragedy, if you find out that you have, God forbid, a serious disease or a relative dies, the way a faithful Catholic understands that is completely different from the way other people understand it, because they understand the salvific value of suffering. They understand the afterlife. They understand that God himself, when he became man primarily to suffer and die. So just let them know what the faith is to you, and it'll resonate in their souls.
Can I ask you a personal question about Edith Stein and what her life is? Has her life had any impact on you in terms of your own journey?
I actually attribute my conversion to her intercession.
Oh, you do? Okay.
I know that you talked to another Jewish convert recently who said the same thing. But in fact, that initial experience when Christ revealed himself to me came very close. I mean, in other words, I don't remember if it was exactly the day, but it came, you know, within 10 days at least of the day that Edith Stein wrote her last will and testament offering her life and all of her suffering for the conversion of her own people. So I've always felt that, I felt that her prayers and the grace that she earned by her sacrifice were in part applied to bring about my conversion.
I know in speaking with a number of friends who are Hebrew Catholics and believers said that one of the greatest form maybe of anti-Semitism you could do is to deny the Jews their Messiah by keeping quiet about who he is.
Absolutely. And also, that's a very sobering thought. We're all going to die. We're all going to be judged. We're all going to see our life in the presence of Jesus. You know, we're going to see it repeated, and God forbid he should show us a little interlude where he says, do you see that person over there? Do you see that moment mm-hmm. when you thought of maybe sharing the gospel with him, but you didn't want to make a fool of yourself? Mm-hmm. I sent you to them, and that was the only chance they had, and you didn't want to make a fool of yourself. Yes. I mean, we'd feel pretty bad if that had happened.
Yes, and the Lord gave you such a grace to see your life in the light of eternity. And the recent popes have all said, you know, that, quoting St. Paul, the blushing of the gospel, if we blush at the gospel, can we be saved? We said, Roy, thank you so much for being with us. Your inspiring story continues to inspire many, me included. God bless you.
God bless. Thanks a lot.
We'll be back in just a moment.